Well, it's certainly an honor to be here tonight. And, of course, I spent a very environmental evening last night watching the Republicans talk about things. And I think Lynn Jackson and I were talking about the excitement on the way over here. And we had the governor of Ohio mentioning that they should have not been talking about the climate over there in Paris. They should have been talking about ISIS. And I couldn't help but thinking when I saw them and heard them, and you talked about recruiting for ISIS, there was a recruiting station going all over the world from with that debate, which was no debate at all. My work with the Pine Bush goes back a long way. I met Rezin Adams in April 1970. When we were speaking at the first Earth Day. It was a very exciting time. We spoke to thousands that day, hundreds at a time. And of course, Lou Ismay was a professor at SUNY at that point in environmental science. And he had a very good class where I met Lynn Jackson. I think she was about 19 years of age.
It was a really long time ago.
Just the other day. And it was a heck of an interesting class. And then we started talking about the Pine Bush and about the Kerner Blues. And certainly, like a lot of endangered species, they have a very finite amount of habitat left. They have a limited lifestyle, which can endanger them. In the case of the Kerner Blues, they are dependent upon the lupins. And not just any lupins. You can't go plant lupins like you would plant in your garden from Europe or something. You're going to have lupins from around here in order to have the Kerner Blue. They just can't be lupins. So I came in there, and there were thousands of lupins at that point, and there were thousands of Kerner Blues. Kerner Blues were very interesting anyway. They were discovered by Nabokov, who was then a professor at Cornell. And he came in by train at Kerner Station and went out and found the butterfly and named it the Kerner Blue because of that location. He was quite the guy, going all around. And, of course, Lolita fame, among other things that he did. All these guys from Cornell, they're something else, aren't they? He was really, really outstanding, though. He put a name on it. Then came along more and more people, more and more destruction of habitat, lupins, roads, parking lots, stores, plans for a lot more. And the habitat was limited in the first place because it was the dunes from the shoreline of the Lake Albany. Thousands of years ago, the sand was deposited from that lake and made that shoreline the way it is. With a very unique, and I remember Meg Stewart, going out there with her classes and taking a look around, and she talked primarily about the herps because she was a herpetologist. But I remember her being very excited. She had placed metal roofing in various places around the Pine Bush because the reptiles would go underneath it for shelter, and you could find them with her classes when she went out and looked. But she was very prominent in drawing interest to the fauna of the site. Gentleman in the back, we met a number of times on the Pine Bush. We had a very good book that you put out on the Pine Bush, which for some reason I didn't have a chapter in it. But on the next book, we'll have a chapter. I'll put a chapter in there. Are you? Well, I'm ready. But after all these years have passed,
and say one thing for sure. Without Save the Pine Bush would be a whole lot smaller. There wouldn't be any Carter Blues left, I think, at all. And bureaucracy can't be expected to do it on their own. And as it turned out, I was very upset with the what happened at the Pine Bush, taking territory for landfill the way they did. And then the administrators, who under different circumstances I would say other things about them, but I realized they were afraid, and every time a load of garbage went into the landfill, they got money for it towards running what was left of the Pine Bush. We're going to have to keep it up, even though these decades have passed, and we've done so much battling there. And some people like Lou Oliver have helped so much. And CEFQ is one of the things. I remember thinking about CEFQ when you got that legal work done and you got them hauled up so that they couldn't. CEFQ would remain in the Pine Bush, but they couldn't build a new one around it or make any major additions to it. And I thought, yeah, well, that's way off. Decades away. Decades passed. And they went to expand, and they couldn't. And now that is a visitor's center to find and learn about the Pine Bush. And a lot of the land that they had in parking lots and had messed up with the CEFQ is now going back to where the Carter Blue and the Buck Moth. You can have a lot of family fun out there. One day, Montana, who's going to be at Cornell here studying biology in a few days, she was just here, she was out there with her brothers, and we were out there looking for buck moths. Where is the buck moth? So all day long, me and the boys and Montana, we went looking for the buck moth. At the time, my youngest son, Ethan Allen, was about 2. So it was about 16, 17 years ago. And all of a sudden, the 2-year-old pointed, and he said, "Buck moth, Dad." And I thought, well, 2 years old, what the heck is going to say something like that? And any old insect went over, and sure enough, there was a buck moth coming out of a cocoon right there around all the dwarf trees that were in the area. Dwarf acorns, dwarf oaks. And sure enough, it was the buck moth. It was the buck moth. A 2.5-year-old found the buck moth. Maybe because he was about that height. And he looked right out there and he saw that buck moth. But we had spent a whole day looking for a buck moth and he found it. I have never forgotten that. That's one of the high points of field work with your children that I did. He, I was hoping, was going to be here tonight. And he'll never forget that either. He was quite a hit with his brothers and sister at that point, too. They were kind of jealous that the baby found the buck moth. It brings up the state a little bit. And, of course, I like the state. I put 41 years in there. Don't worry, I see that. Put the time in, and I'm a little bit worried about the state, DEC, being that close to running the Pine Bush Preserve. So the only really good thing about this, they are prone to being led by politicians and by people with a lot of money. Government is very proud to having that happen. I saw it happen on a daily basis in my 41 years as state pathologist. So that makes it especially good here tonight, because you people are going to continue looking out for the Pine Bush, and it is going to need a lot more work in the future. I can hardly wait to see what's going to happen. The closure of the landfill. No doubt it's got to be closed. and sooner from the point of view of getting the ecology of the area back. The sooner the better. But that's not going to be a cheap, easy thing to do. And it'll be 30 or 40 years after it's done before you can conclude. We'll be getting fairly old by then, Lou. Before we can conclude whether or not we've got real long-term effect there. Because you got to consider all that garbage and all that debris that went in there, it's going to keep giving off chemicals and CO2 and so on for a very long period of time. But I'll tell you, the people who are the administrators out there, the scientists from the State University of New York at Plattsburgh, they lost a lot of scientific respect for me when they defended that landfill because they were benefiting directly by it being there. But I also know that most state workers do buckle under to some degree. It's the nature of the beast. It's one of the bad things about science being as closely associated as it has to be with government. You have the professors tell you in college about scientific integrity and truth and all that. But when you get down to it, and the money is there, the pressures are there, your budget can be impacted by the administrators, a lot of bending of the truth is done. So there's going to be a lot more battles at the Pine Bush, but the fact that there are battles has to do with the fact that you people here tonight had a lot to do with there being something to fight over and there being a pine bush there, because it wouldn't be there without it. So I think we can make it better. We heard about acreage tonight, which the city is going to be turning over. That's much more pine bush, another 40 acres or so, that needs management, that needs to play a role in Connor Blue populations. There's so many unique things out there. The spadefoot toad. I remember seeing spadefoot toads out there. They're not very common. Maybe less common now. And they were over in the vicinity of the lake, 6 Mile Waterworks, but out in the field, in the ruts formed by tires and filled in with water. That's where the spadefoot toads were. So you wonder, we need a lot more looking at the fauna and flora over there. So your new book, I think, may have something to do with and be helpful along those lines. Let's take a look at a few other insects, and we may as well take a look at the monarch butterfly. And knowing I was going to give this talk, I did some checking today with NRDC to see what the latest is on the monarch butterfly. Not that the educational director there is going to know, because the winter is only just beginning. And so we haven't really got good population figures on the monarch. But the monarch has gone from a billion or 2 billion, maybe more than that, butterflies migrating in North America and the United States, down to about 56 million. So there's 56 million butterflies, roughly, that make it to Mexico. The monarch butterfly is an amazing insect. I mean, I remember seeing that as a little boy, but not realizing until I was a pathologist, probably for 20 years, that it actually migrated, or members of the group migrate down to Mexico. In other words, they may start out, say, in Canada, that they head part way, they raise some more young at some more necessary plants, milkweed, along the way. But eventually they make it down to Mexico. And only a few hectares, a relatively small acreage of pine-type trees, conifers, are the home for these butterflies for the winter. So there's so many critical things, and certainly the Mexican land is very critical. Fortunately, they're making some money with tourists coming to see the monarchs in the wintertime. And so that's good. They're making some money in doing that, which means that they're a little less prone to cut those conifers down for lumber down there in Mexico. We also have a lot of pesticide use. And one thing that I saw when I was looking at those bats, I wrote a couple of papers having to do with the bats, the white snout disease. They are mighty skinny bats when you see many of them. They have lost a lot of weight. And it made me wonder if their nutrition could be off, if they didn't get enough insects and they weren't going into their wintering, their winter sites and caves and mines and the like, and the shape that they should be in. Well, I can't answer that. The work has not been done. But I thought that the insects were down, so I thought, geez, I'll call the state entomologist. He's like the state pathologist. He'll have some view on things. I said, I just wanted to know what's happening with insect populations. And I figured that they would hire students from Cornell and Syracuse and such places in the summertime, and that students would go out and do population studies. Nope, no such studies existed on the common insects, so the hard data is not there. Very sad. And the state museum doesn't have the money to hire people to do those kind of things and keep those kinds of records. I wasn't looking for anything really unusual insects, just the ones that we would normally see quite a few of. But there was no such data. Now, since the strokes, one of the things I wanted to be before that when I was a kid was a farmer. And I grew up raising a lot of animals. I had chores to do. I had animals to feed when I came home from school. I worked milking cows and cutting hay. And I love farming, so it got to be kind of a question, will I go to college or will I go for farming? Well, money was a big factor. My father didn't make it through World War II unscathed. He died. So there was no money, no cows to inherit, no barns, no equipment. So it made going to Syracuse pretty easy. It was easier to go to Syracuse than it was to for me to become a farmer. But I always had that in the back of my mind, that one of the things I'd like to be is a farmer. So with a stroke, actually a bunch of strokes, I decided that gardening would be really a good thing. One, I could struggle around the box raised beds where I raised plants with my walker, and I could study what was going on and see it grow. So I've done a lot of experiments, and one thing I've noticed, there aren't very many insects. And I saw no monarch butterflies. I spent a lot of time outdoors, a lot of time. Not one monarch butterfly. A couple of tiger swallowtails, a lot of cabbage moths, but not one monarch butterfly came by. And it's in a fairly good place where you would expect to see monarchs. There's even a little bit of milkweed around Diamond Ridge in the Lansingburg area of Troy. But those monarchs are not there. And that's a loss. It's a personal loss to me because I admired those butterflies like a lot of you do when we were kids. We admired seeing them. They were beautiful. We liked seeing them. They're flying flowers. They were absolutely beautiful. They're not flying much anymore. And there's only 56 million of them. And we don't want to think that we got too many Karner Blues either, because they're importing the Karner Blues and stocking them from New Hampshire in the pine bush so they can have some out there, right? It's a good thing that they're doing that, but we expected that they would have self-sustaining Karner Blues. We certainly had dumps and stuff like that, but it's going to be some more time before they are self-sustaining. So what I'm saying is that, you know, you can go to any group of animals you want. In this case, we're dealing with the Karner Blue and the monarch butterfly. They're both still in trouble. It doesn't tell you what kind of condition they're going to be in 100 years or 50 years. we can make this scientifically more complex because we've got climate change going, and we've got new pesticides going out into the environment all the time that kill bees, and they can kill monarch butterflies as well. The research hasn't been done for comparison. And I think not too long ago, I saw in the Times Union a piece where people were wondering what would happen with genetic engineering. People are concerned about it. Well, genetic engineering has had an impact on the monarch butterfly, a heck of an impact on it. What happened was Monsanto of PCB fame, Brian Bush, quite a PCB researcher there. He and I shared a couple of papers. He was certainly big in capillary chromatography, where you actually could look at the specific congeners of PCBs. Monsanto produced the PCBs that GE put in their capacitors and transformers, and a lot of other companies as well. They've got a lot of scientists. They've got a lot of money. They decided that they would go into corn. So they produced a lot of corn seed, and they did some genetic manipulation of corn. So they produced corn that was immune to dying from glyphosate, one of the herbicides that they produce and sell in very large quantities and have been for a long time. So the farmers bought it and they applied it, and they could plant this corn and they'd grow corn. Before, you'd put the herbicide in, it killed your corn along with the weeds. This kills primarily weeds. However, it hasn't been worked out yet what will happen over time, because there are a lot of weeds, and there's a lot of time, and there's genetic mutations occurring all the while. So one could expect that plants will become immune with rapidity to the herbicide. But they are at present time treating millions of acres. So that means there's 60 million or so acres of land in the United States planted to corn. And the corn is immune to the glyphosate. But of course, the milkweed that the butterfly needs is not. So there's millions of acres less milkweed than it used to be. That's one of the problems with the monarch butterfly. It's not simple, it's complex, there are a number of factors, but that is a major one. Now think about that, because we're going to see a lot more genetic manipulation. Some of it will be good. However, you got to think about these things, what it means overall. Do we think it's just raising corn? Maybe to sell for ethanol production, for additive in gasoline? Or are we going to think about what it means ecologically, too? And, of course, we really ought to do that. We need to move away, if we want to save the monarch, from Monsanto's experiments here and their money-making with the glyphosate use that's going on. And they also put kind of a corner on the corn seed market, because it was their corn with their paperwork, government paperwork on it, saying that they own that and they can sell the corn besides the chemicals. You knew about that, Brian? Yeah. So that's something that we have got to think about as we see in more and more of the genetic engineering being used. We better look and make sure what's happening with it. NRDC is taking a look at it. Bobby Kennedy has been looking at the honeybees for NRDC, but he has not been feeling too well. So other people are taking over that. But looking at the honeybees are way down, right? We don't see the insects. Have you noticed that we used to be, you would go on the front porch or the back porch and you'd have a porch light? You'd see all the insects swirling around the light? And the bats even coming in and swirling around the light? You don't see that much anymore. Not many insects are flying around out there. They're greatly reduced. Well, the honeybees, there's neonicotinamides. Neonics, I think they call them for short. And there's quite a few of them. And they are really deadly to bees and probably a bunch of other insects, but certainly to bees. And aphids are one of the things that they are widely used for. And New York in the 2000s has taken a look at them, and they allowed them on a number of crops. We've got lots of them applied here in New York. Which brings up, where's the pesticide research in New York State? Where are those people? Where have they gone? Where have all the pesticides, where's Joan Baez when you need her? Where have all the pesticide researchers gone? They're on the side of the environment. Going to graveyards, almost every one. And they're not being replaced. The graveyard may be a bureaucratic graveyard, but they went there. Something needs to be done. The honeybees are way down over much of their range. And of course, they were never here like the Carter blue and the monarch butterfly are natives to this area. They were here pre-Columbian. Not so with the bees. They came with the early colonists. And when the colonies expanded, and before they actually expanded, the Indians in some areas called them white men's flies, because the bees would show up a little bit before the white people in their cabins and so on showed up. But they are very important. So many of our crops are pollinated by them. Say nothing about honey in our tea and for cooking. I remember when I was a kid, you could go to an apple tree and you didn't have to see the apple tree. You just listened and you would hear the humming of the bees in the flower. The whole tree would be humming, covered with bees. That's rare now. The bees just are not here. What these insects are telling us is we better take a hard look at what is happening with the insects, whether we're talking about the concern about them, like I was with the bat food, the state of nutrition of bats, or whether we're talking about the pollinization of crops like squash and apples and pears and crops that we grow, that we need for producing food. We need that. We need to do a lot with the honeybees. Now, I wanted to talk about some of the things that are very, very important. And certainly looking at toxic substances, pesticides and others is very important. Now, I haven't finished yet studying that cement plant down in Ravenna. I've found a bunch of stuff down there. Harvard came. They found some people with elevated levels. And then they came under attack. And they went back to Harvard and went to California rather than fight on. In my case, why not fight on? It's in me to do that. So I've got an enormous amount of data down there. And I found mercury moving, but I also found cadmium moving. And now that some of the biggest interferences on places like that, I think, are gone. One of them at the very highest levels in state government had some indirect, if not direct, involvement in the in that plant. So we need to have a strong bureau of insecticides or toxics or something within DEC looking at these things. And the pathology unit, as it was run by me, they don't ever want to see that again, should be looking out there to see whether or not the animals are dying and what they're dying from, because the animals are good indicators of what is happening in the environment and what the mortality factors are. And it has comparative medical value besides ecological value and value to the species that are dying, that things can be changed so that those species can be managed better than they were. Now, endangered species, Peter Nye was at my retirement here, has gone, and I think endangered species is tiny compared to what it was. Makes no sense. Should take a look at DEC's endangered species unit, the amount of effort that goes into it, because we're not going to have fewer endangered species. The turmoil in the world, the wide variety of chemicals, the changes that we have, they all mean we're going to have more endangered species, not less. So that's one of the things. And of course, you've got the Carter blue. The buck moth is not an endangered species yet, but they're not enormous populations because they're limited by a limited habitat. So something needs to be done. Things are missing that are obviously being put aside. And they hate endangered species, right? Because then there are laws set that you have to take care of the endangered species. Maybe you can't build a factory or thousands of houses in an area because there's an endangered plant or animal living in that area. And these can be of a wide variety. You name the group of animals, it's going to have endangered species in it in about all areas, because we are really waging war. In my opinion, the most important war that is being fought is not the world war with ISIS. It's not battles in Afghanistan. It is the battle, the war, that mankind is waging against the earth itself. The very thing that we're dependent on, the air, the water, the fauna, things that we need to survive, that's being not being taken care of. It's being ignored. That is the most important war that we are in. I'm going to finish up a little bit. To conclude, see, Jane Goodall is still at it. Jimmy Carter, bless his soul. Montana wrote a letter. My daughter wrote a letter to Jimmy Carter about fracking. He wrote back in his own handwriting, a paragraph or so, and he was against fracking. Jane Goodall is now an old lady, and she's slowing down, but she is, upset about what's happening with the chimpanzees. What's happening with the gorillas? What's happening with the African elephants? The Asian elephants? They're all getting decreased in population tremendously. So that basically the number of endangered species is growing and growing. And what are we doing about that? Not much. And if you don't have places in the bureaucracies where you have scientists that are studying this that have some power to say something about it, you're not going to know about it. The general public is not going to know until you read that the thing has gone extinct, or they think it's extinct, like one of the rhinoceros species. So one of the things that the Save the Pine Bush may want to do is check with the bureaucracies and see what's going on with the insecticides and what's going on with wildlife pathology, and what's going on in other areas of interest. Certainly the pathology, the insecticides and endangered species need immediate probes to see what kind of coverage we have got. And I think you'll find not much. It's great to be back. And there's a lot of battles to be fought. And these are just a few of them. And they are huge. There's been a lot of thinking about endangered species when the dentist went over and shot the big lion. The lions are not endangered yet, but they're heading in that direction. And you have some highly educated nitwit shooting the biggest lion so he can put it up on the wall and say he got one of the last big lions in that part of Africa. First of all, we need to raise kids that are a little more concerned about the environment and about living things, not killing them in the first place. It's not the same as an African kid reaching manhood and going out with a spear to kill a lion at close range. We're talking about baiting the lion over and shooting it with telescopic sights with a high-powered rifle. That's a very different kind of a thing. While we're on Africa and color, what do we hear about the Native Americans? We are not hearing about the Native Americans. And they have suffered for hundreds of years by what we do. And I did quite a bit of fighting myself for Native Americans, but not as much as I should. So let me say that we need to start dealing with the Native Americans a little more, listening to them, and helping them, because they've gotten a raw deal for a long time, and it is continuing. So when it comes to dealing with people, when it comes to dealing with the environment, we're doing a bad job, and my opinion is we don't want anybody who was up there last night in that debate when the Republicans taking over. I do not care for Obama's policies on the environment, but he's got some, and I think his heart is in the right place, and he doesn't know everything to do. But these guys are much worse than Obama, they're thinking. We need better people going into politics who are interested in the environment, and it's up to Save the Pine Bush and groups like this to make the politicians realize that there's a lot that we got to do on the environment. And that needs to be started by me 40 years ago or so, when it was. And now I'm back and I can go get them again. Thank you very much.
Is there time for some questions?
Oh, yeah.
Do you want to have a seat? Would you be more comfortable? We'd be happy to let you sit down. What would you prefer?
Ready? You're always a little bit unpredictable. Any rebel learns that.
Any questions?
As a young man and growing up, I'm really concerned about the environment, especially about the global warming and about extinct animals and so forth. And we really have to take care of the earth and so forth. And the countries really have to have cooperation to save the atmosphere and so forth. And what do you think about the Paris conference?
Well, I think it's a good thing that we had it. I think Obama is right about that. However, I don't think it's going to do a whole lot of good, because it does have a weight of law behind it. It doesn't have, China can do this, and India can do that, and Taiwan can do this. The U.S. has this amount that they can put out
There's no enforcement of that. So what's going to happen back home? Business people are going to say to the governor, whoever the governor may be, whatever language, nation that is, we won't be able to compete with them if we do this. We control the pollution. So much of it will be gone into the atmosphere. It's a step in the right direction, but it's a shaky step. And it needs to have a lot more behind it than what we've got from the Paris meeting.
That's true, and I think that if we had the Cato Conference for the Environment, it will make the Earth much better and so forth, okay?
I agree with you.
Okay.
Lou.
Lord, with all your experience, looking back, understanding the situation that exists, good and the bad, thinking ahead, is there some guiding principle, some phrase, something that all of us could be looking at and thinking about the next time around, whatever that might be? For example, as I listen to you, all I could think of, and I'm asking your opinion, a guiding principle. Well, we have one in the medical profession. Do no harm. Should that be something that we all think about in terms of the planet? Is there something that you can suggest?
Yeah, we should have the equivalent of that. And obviously you teach the children that. And I did teach that to my kids, I think. And a number of them are majoring in biology because of that. But the whole society has got to do that. And we've got to live by what we say too. Haven't always done that, and probably none of you have lived by the ideals that you have, but we've got to have more of us living by the ideals of taking care of the earth, which is one of the things I found attractive about the Native Americans. Was the, I remember I asked him, I said, what's your religion? He said, well, we don't have really a religion. I said, the Indian way of doing it is a way of life. So if you talk to people like Tom Porter, they wake up in the morning, there's an Iroquois prayer about the morning. And they thank the birds for being there, and they thank nature. I'm not sure that I understood everything that they were saying to me at the time. But we have got to teach our kids to respect nature. And we do some of that. We've got five rivers and places like that. But that's only just a beginning. And they don't even have the kind of teachers, I think, that they need to have at places like Five Rivers to teach the kids. But we need to respect nature, and we need to teach our kids to do that. And none of us probably respect nature as much as we should, even if we are people that think we have done it for a long time, we can get a lot better. Yes?
I was quite involved in the efforts regarding the Rubina cement plant. And a couple of questions is, I was wondering if we really gained anything there in terms of the modernization of that plant. Did we get a better outcome than we otherwise would have gotten? And what kind of next steps are you thinking in terms of that?
Well, I actually found in the wildlife, and I didn't kill any wildlife. I just picked the deer and stuff off the road, rabbits off the road, and looked at their livers, their kidneys, their tissues for things like cadmium. I picked the tissues that would be likely to expect to see cadmium build up. Brian knows what I'm talking about with a lichen. Your kidney would be an obvious place to look for cadmium. And I've got the data, and I can still pull that data. I can still work on that data. So we've got the making of the data. I've just got to be able to round it out. So I'm working on standing up and walking, and my mind seems to be working pretty well from the point of view of science. So I'm going to be able to, I think, do that. We have got a lot of data. I've got the data to publish a couple of papers. It's just a matter of getting that data, working it up, and maybe updating it a little bit. And we could have some publications on it. I think the question was, do I think that we made a lot of progress? Well, I'll tell you, my first run-in with that cement plant was about 1970. Might even been 69. Flew over the place in a Piper Cub. We were on our way to Long Island to look at dead ducks. We had a lot of ducks dying from an exotic disease down there. And we flew over that, and you could, it was an appalling black mass of particulate matter in the air that we flew through. You could smell it. And about that time, that mass was falling down on cars at night when it was still, and it resulted in damage to paint, which I think is the only real court case that ever really took place down there, was one on the paint, not on lungs or brains or death of mate or anything, just a paint on cars.
Well, what's more important? Oh, sorry. Our cars. We got to have our cars.
So there needs to be some work. And this is what I noted, though. I can't remember the name of the man now, but he was a Marine Corps officer at one point, so he said, and he was the regional director. So they had done a good job in looking. Well, they didn't look at all. There really wasn't any looking. There was never a good scientific study done on that plant. To this day, it wasn't. Do I think it was good? Well, I think it'll do good, but there's something really interesting there. You, if you fly over that, you'll see what looks like mountains. You go down the thruway, you look over past Ravenna towards Ravenna School, you see these hills. Well, it's like a wisdom tooth that's in somebody who's 65, 70 years old and used their teeth and had many fillings. There isn't anything beside the edge of the mountain going up, and then there's a big hole where they took out the rock, and you can see where there's a transport over the highway, and they bust up that rock, and then they burn it. Well, even to me, it was enlightening that we would discuss this on the way here, too, that you don't have to have high levels of something in the rock. When you burn hundreds of millions of pounds per year, you put out a lot of pollutants from rock that doesn't have high levels. In other words, there's no mercury, high levels of mercury in the rock down there. But there's mercury and there's cadmium and a variety of other chemicals that are noxious. And when the cement is made, these are released in one way or another into the air. In the case of mercury, a lot of mercury goes out because that's very volatile. It goes into the atmosphere quite readily. So mercury is important down there. But they very badly wanted that company to stay there, to do well. That was a driving force in state government to make it too tough on the industries to drive them out. And that's exactly what they do. So that's why I say you've got to have the wildlife pathology, you've got to have the pesticide bureaus, you need those people looking at things who can get the facts on what's going on and do something about it. And right now, I can see they're weaker than they used to be by far.
Yeah, Tom?
Yeah, have you paid much attention to the partial cleanup that General Electric did in the Hudson River, and what do you think needs to be done? They're claiming that they did enough and that they complied with what they said they were going to do. And other scientists are saying that they haven't done anywhere near what they said they were going to do, and that a lot of the measurements that have been taken prove it.
Well, first of all, the government allowed the industry to get by for generations with the PCBs out there before they did any cleanup. So much of the PCBs that were in the river actually went down the river A little aside, I can remember being out in the river with Pete Seeger and saying, Pete, that's what PCBs smell like. I claimed to that I could smell PCBs. But I also said, whatever I smelled them that I wanted to find out, I had the proper chemical analyses done, some by Brian's lab, that would show that the PCBs were really there. So I think that they have not done all of the cleanup that they should. And one place is where I have some data, is the Champlain Canal. The Lake Champlain Canals, I know the PCBs are there, because I took the samples myself, and I found the PCBs there. And that's a place where they need to be cleaned up. Are they always going to let General Electric get away? Well, they're going to try. But that's a place where a few analyses are already in existence. They can be rechecked for the times. And there will be more places to clean up next summer. They are out there.
Just a follow-up. A lot of people say, how did the PCBs go up the Champlain Canal? How did the PCBs...
For one thing, there's a landfill, which is right there adjacent to part of the canal. So they made their way from the landfill into the canal. And the canal flows, and particulate matter to which the PCB is attached to gets stirred up, and there's a flow. So they move by that.
Is there a legal, I know it was a rule with the department, the EPA, can the public take a suit against individuals or a community take a suit against GE to force them to clean up not only that portion but also clean up the existing plant because they want to use that plant, the community wants to use it as a, after they clean up the plant, into urban renewable area.
Stan?
They want to use that plant as almost like what they did in certain places in Connecticut, not sure it's a...
Well, since I'm not an attorney, I'm going to pass that off to Lou. But I would say that we need to be able to identify the stuff and then take legal action. And legal action costs money. And it is that lack of money that people find that stops a lot of good environmental litigation by citizens from being done.
Do you want to answer that question?
Lou?
People who formerly used the canal for any reason, who can't use it now, would have standing to sue. And the towns adjacent to the canal who have lost the ability to use the canal and have commerce from the canal would also have standing to sue. But it is very hard for community groups to raise money, because in order to bring a lawsuit like that, you have to have experts and who are willing to put in hundreds of hours of time. And that's, or you have to have a town or a local government that's willing to finance a major litigation like that.
First thing I remember Ward teaching us was how the deer, when they were shooting all the PCBs at hunters, were getting all their all the deer. They were having cancer. So one of the things, Ward, because of you, my sister was a pharmacist at Fort Edward Pharmacy, and she did a study with Fort Edward. All these students, one of the people that used to work in her pharmacy at, over here from Pharmacy College, did a study. And guess what they found? She couldn't understand why there were so many human beings, how many people coming in with a cancer of the eye. And I told her, I
listen to your presentation at the environment forum. You had made a presentation about how the deer were getting their, you know. And is there still standing all those people after all those 45, 50 years? They're all, they still have the list of all those people, the people who have been damaged. Is there still, could they as a group still fight what had happened there?
Well, I think there's been a turnover. There's been a lot of other scientists come on the scene. And I think that a lot of those scientists were more amenable to being bent than people like Brian Bush and myself were. So there had to be some more sampling, some more looking at what's going on, including with the deer, because so much time has passed. But I think the problem is still out there. And of course, you got to look at the PCBs too, is that where it was concentrated in the river, they either stirred it up and they sent some downriver, but a lot of the PCBs go into the atmosphere. And remember the goldenrod along the river, Brian? Mm-hmm. The goldenrod has flowers that are quite oily. And so the PCBs are volatilizing out of the river, make their way over to the goldenrod, and they get snagged and concentrated on the flowers of the goldenrod, for example. And the goldenrod are eaten by deer, by the way. That's a food that deer like. But there are just so many things to study and so many things to do. And they don't fit well into state hours. 37 and a half hour work weeks with vacations and time for time cards and all that sort of thing. You have very little time for actually doing anything really worthwhile. I would not advise too many young people to go into government work. So I would advise my own kids to do it because they control you. You don't want to be controlled as a scientist. You want to be able to pursue a hypothesis and evaluate it versus the null hypothesis. And it's pretty hard to do that when if you pursue the hypothesis and the hypothesis turns out to be what the administration doesn't want, and they're being influenced by places like General Electric, then they're going to make it pretty hard for you. I'll give you an example of smelling PCBs. I said, well, I smell PCBs. And I was on a Alcoa plant, Reynolds Metals, up at Akwesasne, east of Messina. And I had been talking about all the PCBs and pollutants, and they had up there the people that were consultants for Reynolds taking samples. This kid said to me, I hear that you can smell the PCBs. And he kind of chuckled, you know. I said, yeah, I can smell them. He said, well, that's not very scientific. That's not scientific at all. Ha, ha, ha. I said, it may not be scientific, but I always take another sample. And right where you're standing, I took some samples. And you've been working all week looking for chemicals other than PCBs and working in PCBs all week long without taking any care whatsoever. He wasn't laughing too much longer. It turned out that, yes, I was right. There were lots of PCBs there. And a fair amount of microcontaminants at very significant levels, dibenzofurans and dioxins as well. It's kind of like the old days, isn't it, Brian?
Yeah, well, the company, I gave a talk like you just gave, but I was in New Jersey at a hearing with a judge, and lo and behold, Monsanto was president. They had been here listening to this group, and yet they were able to bring up what they wanted, what was being said here. So we are, in fact, being listened to. And we all know that we've done a lot of good work with the actual pine bush, but this PCB work is really mysterious. And not being looked at by the government anymore. They put their hands in the air and said, we can't do it anymore.
Any more questions?
I have one.
Lou, yes.
I want to ask Ward, as a former state bureaucrat, see, do you think it would be a good thing if DEC was split up into a standards-setting department and a permitting department? Isn't there a natural conflict that DEC does both sets the standards and decides who can make money by polluting the environment?
I think that has to be looked at. That under certain settings, that certainly would be superior. I would give you an example. I complained about the Bureau of Pesticides. And they still do quite a bit of pesticide work. But you know, they license the pesticide people that apply the pesticides. That was a major business with them and a major thing under the law. So a lot of the bureaucrats were on giving exams and administering licenses and seeing that the licenses were carried out and properly. And in other words, if you inspect people with licenses on occasion, like seldom, and keep on going with that kind of thing. And they're the same people that were monitoring for pesticides in the environment. They're monitoring to see whether the people that the state was licensing were actually creating an environmental problem. It's hard to do that. It's hard to monitor such people under such a situation, which comes down to your splitting up between the management group and the people who are looking for things and creating standards. That needs to be looked at. I think in some situations it would be the way to go, would be to split up to get away from that. And that's an example right there that I gave you where splitting, I think, is absolutely necessary. And I think there are many. That was one of the nice things about me in wildlife pathology. We were independent. So we would find things and they wouldn't necessarily agree with health or anybody else. So you then you would take a look and see who was right. And usually I was right. But it needs, that is a good thing to look at, would be to some splitting, which is away from what government is trying to do. They're lumping more and more things together. And of course, more and more things get lost along the way too. Wildlife pathology money went to Cornell. Now, one of the things I used to say, driving all these strokes and going down, was, if Cornell was so hot, how come they didn't see that they were doing anything with the pesticides? They weren't doing anything with them. Anything may be a little bit extreme, or I might have to pull that back, but they were doing very, very little. In fact, when I went down to testify in front of Congress, or the EPA hearings in Washington, I frequently had to face highly paid Cornell personnel testifying on behalf of the pesticide. And of course, if I testified on behalf of an environmental group and took money, it would be a conflict of interest of some kind. So you couldn't do any of that, but the professors certainly could do that and did. So I had some wonderful days when defeated professors from Cornell over diazinon and other pesticides.
You had a question.
Yes. I was wondering, have you heard anything about any research or information about what's going on with the microbeads?
Microbeads as far as picking up PCBs and...
Yeah, well, they said that there's like an exfoliant or some and face washes, and there's microbeads that the companies are putting in there as a scrubbing agent, and it's going into the water and bidding into the fish and the snails and...
No, I've heard the same thing. I've seen the same kind of thing in the literature, too. I think some of the microchips are made up of those bodies that you're talking about. They are showing up in fish, I know that much. It's not something I've done myself.
Yeah.
But when I saw that in the literature, that's something that should be looked at. That's something that I would have looked at pretty quickly.
You don't know if there's anybody that's taken any steps or anything to look at it, to do any studies on it.
I think in DEC, after me, I think people would be very careful about what they look at. And make sure that they have approval and proper discussions and so on before they look at those things.
There is legislation in the state legislature to try and restrict microbes. And certain counties have been working on passing legislation. A piece of legislation was introduced into Rensselaer County by the minority, unfortunately, to legislate against the microbes. So there is a general interest and awareness that it's not a good thing to be doing.
I'm interested in looking at those microbeads.
Sylvia?
Yeah, do you think that the de facto elimination of academic tenure has some bearing on how badly the professors behave in some of these situations?
I would think that in some cases, yes. It's usually got to do with money, though. And, of course, tenure does have to do with money.
George.
Yeah. As a phylactopathologist, listening right to you, have you guys looked into nanotechnology, nanoparticles, and do you feel it's okay that the leaders of the nanotechnology industry, all the doctors and professors pushing all their doctors, students saying that it's okay to pump nanoparticles in the water system?
Well, there's certainly a lot of people saying that, but there aren't the studies to go on the other side the way they ought to. That's something I'd like to be able to do, and I think I could still do that.
Yes.
I'm just wondering if anyone has tried to find any kind of record on how much money is put up for graduate students to do research in some of these areas. There's nothing like that sort of thing to get a little something going, provided they've got a good article on the topic out there to stir everybody.
It should be, that could be done.
Well, that's a start.
What happens, though, is that a lot of times professors and departments can be absolutely honest because they'll say that they are looking at a particular kind of thing, not looking for the harmfulness of the thing that is running their department, and providing all the money.
But they don't decide all of this. A notice can be put on a bulletin board saying what's available. Student can read it and apply. Anyway, we shouldn't waste any more time on this.
No, it needs to be done. Mm-hmm. But it won't be an easy thing to trace. But if you think you can go to a department, it's the questions that you ask, right?
Been there and done all this.
Yeah.
Why I'm asking.
No, not you, but you know, the way you ask the questions, the scientists ask the questions, has a lot to do with what questions are asked as to what you find. So departments that are not environmental and don't want to find pathology in fishes don't raise those kinds of questions.
No, yeah, this I understand. I think this is a long time and place for this.
So you need to raise that question and then take a look at it. But I think that a lot of the basic research has not been done. So we're going to have to find a way of getting funding for that and people to carry it out.
Well, it all goes back to money. Mm-hmm. That was because I was trying to read up.
It doesn't always go back to money, but largely to money. I always had the idea that I could make a difference without money. And that was my idea, and I often did. And I think it was going pretty good guns until the little strokes began happening. And I began walking into the wall. Now I'm coming back somewhat. So the fight is still there. I had those strokes, I just laid there in bed and I thought chemistry and math and biological theories and so on. So I was crouched up in my bed in a fetal position. People came to visit me, thought I was about dead, but I was thinking. I was thinking great thoughts. Mostly thoughts that I had thought before or heard professors say before, 20, 30, 40, 50 years before. But they all ran through my mind because I figured that thinking like that would get these neurons working. And you got to consider, I couldn't sit up. They would set me up like this and I would go down. They would get me up out of bed and I couldn't stand. I'd fall over. There weren't too many people thought that I was going to come back. But Montana did. My kids thought I'd come back.
I think you sound a lot stronger and mentally sharper than you did a year ago. You really do. You sound like...
Well, I've grown up another year.
Well, you remind me of the Ward Stone of 20 or 30 years ago. Whereas a year ago, I wasn't so sure, but now I am. You know, I think you're fully recovered from your strokes.
Thank you.
We'll take one more question.
Thank you very much.
This is Kenneth. Another thing on the side, this government really established as a republic, that everybody be represented and so forth. How do you think that we can turn around the state, these 50 states and the federal government to turn around to us as the people be represented to listen to us and so forth? About our needs and our social policies and our environment, what do you think we should be doing that?
Well, I think you need to be a squeaky wheel.
Okay.
and I think you are. We need a lot of squeaky wheels. Mm-hmm. I think that the Democrats are much more likely to do protection of the environment than other Republicans, unfortunately. I didn't see any environmentalism at all last night.
That's true.
Not any at all. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was amazing. And if you all are the way they were, when I say you all, those men who were up there and one lady debating last night, they were all after Muslims. The Muslims are going to be on edge about that. You even got people saying that when I was in the military myself for four and a half years, I was a Navy corpsman. I intended to kill nobody. I intended to be brave, but I didn't want to kill anybody. So I wouldn't want to fly over and drop bombs and on the people and kill them. I mean, we had people justifying saying that they could kill kids. You kill a bunch of people, and some of them are children. Maybe you'll get the war over faster that way. Yeah, I'd say you're going to have.
That was Carson who said that.
Yeah, he said it last night, but other people have said the same thing or are a little bit different. That's surprising for a doctor to say that. You know, one person at a time. So anyway, when I was over there in Detroit in the Coast Guard, and I was playing football in Chatham, and the guy said, "Hey, you join the Coast Guard." 17 years old, senior in high school, I joined the Coast Guard. Go up there, sign my name. This is an exciting night, so you go up there and we dressed in our little uniforms and tied knots and the Coast Guard was fine. But I did that for a couple of months and I said to the Coast Guard, "I'm getting out, sir, I'm going." I've had all the Coast Guard I want. 12 weeks, whatever it was. They said, well, you can't do that. You signed up for 7 years.
Oops.
4 years of active duty, 3 years of reserve. So I went to the Navy because they heard they had the corpsman. I said, I'd like to be a corpsman. They said, fine. We'll write the Coast Guard, get an honorable discharge for you. We'll give you 7 more years. Well, I took that. I never regretted it. My father got TB in the Philippines and died from the TB. They never were able to stop it. So, and if you remember, people our age, we faced being drafted or 4 years as a volunteer. So I chose to become a Navy corpsman. But I'm not into bombing and killing people. I think we've done enough of that. The world has had enough of that. We need to get along with people around the world. And I'll say one thing for Obama. And I think there are a number of good things about Obama. One of them is that I believe that the actions that he has taken will cut down a little bit on the prejudice that's in this country. That will be more like one people, which is the direction we have to move in. And we have to get along for the world being one people. What does DNA tell us? We are one species, one kind of animal. DNA, we are pretty much the same.
I'd like to tell you about this commentary that I listened on the radio this morning. 23-year-old, his father showed him what happened to Japan with the A-bombs. And he said, hey, you don't know what the arsenal is in these different countries and so forth? Hey, when the A-bomb is dropped, everybody be wiped out. And then even the few people who live and fight with sticks. Okay.
All right, one more question. Lou, why don't you close us out?
Regarding George.
Do you have another comment? Well, I want to thank everyone for coming. Thank you so much, Ward. It's wonderful, wonderful to see you. And I absolutely agree with Tom.
Thank you.
And we got to keep fighting the fight, right?
Thank you for encouraging me. And I'm ready to do some scientific balance on the environment, for sure. You made some very good sense.
Yes, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Good to see you too.
Oh, yes. It's wonderful.
Yeah, it's been a while.
All right.
Well, it's no wonder I'm renewed. I lay there in bed.